Hello and welcome to The Stooshy, the Scottish politics podcast from DC Thompson Media that helps you be better briefed. I'm Paul Malik, and on this episode I'll be joined by Andy Phillip, Rachel Amory and the award-winning Leslie Ann Kelly to examine and explain the last week in Scottish politics. But first, a summary of the week's biggest national and international politics stories, compiled and read by Morag Lindsay.
Scotland's newly launched vaccine passport app has been hit by technical problems. The NHS Scotland COVID status app was made available to download on Apple and Android devices on Thursday afternoon. From 5am on Friday, people attending large events and nightclubs will need to show proof they have had two doses of vaccine using the app before they are allowed in. But just hours after the app's launch, comments circulating on social media suggested many users have been unable to register on it. The Scottish Government said the large volume of people accessing the app at once could be a reason for the glitch. Teaching unions have declared a formal dispute with the Scottish Government and local councils after rejecting a pay offer. The EIS and three other unions who make up the teacher side of the Scottish Negotiating Committee for Teachers rejected a 1.22% pay rise earlier this year, saying it was below inflation and a real terms cut. Union officials claim COSLA and the Scottish Government have failed to respond with an improved offer. They say there is growing frustration within the profession as teachers feel they are undervalued. The union submitted the pay claim in December last year. Responding to the dispute, a Scottish Government spokesperson said, "We will continue to play our part positively and constructively on pay negotiations." Motorists could face another week or so of long queues at the filling stations as demand for petrol remains strong, a UK government minister has warned. Policing Minister Kit Malthouse said there needs to be an improvement in the situation in the coming days and that Boris Johnson stands ready to review matters if there is any deterioration. His downbeat assessment contrasted sharply with comments by other ministers in recent days that the situation would swiftly return to normal as drivers resumed their usual buying patterns. It follows a warning by the Petrol Retailers Association that filling stations were running out of fuel faster than they could be resupplied, with one in four forecourts having run dry.
Thank you, Morag. In the words of James Hetfield, give me fuel, give me fire, give me that which I desire. Empty fuel pumps, empty Christmas shelves, and a vaccine passport which just doesn't work. It's been another week in Scottish and UK politics. Let's start first with the crisis at our fuel pumps. Now, we had the UK Business Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng declare that the so-called crisis was not in fact a crisis, was just stupid customer purchases. Rachel, have you had issues filling your car this week? I know I have, mainly that it's been so expensive and that I had to wait some time. Talk us through what your week has been like with this post-Brexit Britain, which sees a lack of food on shelves, a lack of stock in shops, and a bit of a queue at the petrol station.
Well, last week we were talking about this fuel crisis starting off, and it's been a whole week now, and we're still sort of in the same position, aren't we? There's still pumps running dry. The Petrol Retailer Association is actually saying 27% of petrol stations across the UK have actually completely run dry this week, which is quite a large number when you think about it, isn't it? And obviously with the queues piling up as well, that obviously causes problems with people getting stuck in traffic, whether that's key workers who need to get somewhere or buses that are trying to stick to a strict timetable. That's all sort of a knock-on effect of it as well. So, yeah, the petrol station one's still rumbling on. And, yeah, there is obviously the problem with getting things onto the shelves in supermarkets as well. I know I went to the supermarket earlier this week and was struggling to get tinned tomatoes. That was the one thing I was left looking for in my shop. So, yeah, it's certainly still a problem, isn't it? And earlier this week, Nicola Sturgeon did say she has some very real concerns about what's going to happen this Christmas. Is the HGV labour shortage and the fuel crisis going to continue on into then? And that means we might then struggle to get the food and other things that we want for Christmas to us. Somebody was actually speaking on the radio this morning saying that while people might just have to sort of reprioritise things for Christmas, they might not get the exact brand they're used to for Christmas dinner, but they'll still get something. So she was sort of suggesting that people should not panic too much, just maybe expect things to be slightly different this year for Christmas. And obviously last year we had a very different Christmas because there was a lot of restrictions placed on us last Christmas, wasn't there? So
yeah, so it hasn't really been Christmas as normal almost since Brexit happened. Andy, we have conflicting advice from UK and Scottish governments. The Scottish government is saying that this is all the result of Brexit, and the UK government is saying it's all the result of the pandemic. Which are we to believe?
First it was a pingdemic, and then it was the HGV drivers. And I've quite enjoyed how people have sort of tried to slowly rationalize this as being fine. Like, we can't get any fresh food, but it's okay because, you know, our grandparents did fine with a couple of tatties in the back garden during the war. And I saw people sort of speculating, well, maybe it's time that we just stopped having turkey at Christmas because it's just a cheap chicken. It's not very good. You know, it'll be fine. We don't need that. It's weird rationalizing. I also think the sort of evolution of the slogan has been quite interesting too. I mean, in recent years, we've had Brexit means Brexit, get Brexit done, and now behave normally, which I think is the best of them all. But yeah, it's not the most inspirational political slogan capturing imaginations at the moment. So there's so much going on. There's so many moving parts. We are living through some particularly weird times. But I mean, I look around Europe as a whole and I look at how things were a couple of years ago and how things are now, makes it pretty clear that this is a pretty perfect storm of everything, and Brexit indeed has quite a big part to play in it all.
So like the ambulance crisis that we talked about a few weeks ago and last week, it seems that the army haven't come and step in. Usually in a film or in a book, when the army gets to the point of stepping in, that's almost like last resort, isn't it? Before everything just goes completely bottoms up. Now, I'm not suggesting for a second that that is what is going to happen, but it doesn't look good when you have to have soldiers driving trucks to deliver fuel to petrol stations and to make sure that there are bread on the shelves. Rachel, we have been warned by the Rotology Association that there are a shortage and have been a shortage of heavy goods vehicles drivers, HGV drivers, for some time. They estimate between 60,000 and 70,000. Is there any indication that the relaxed immigration rules, or the so-called relaxed immigration rules, which will see EU drivers allowed into our country to save our Christmas, but only till Christmas Eve, will actually attract anyone over?
I'm unsure about this one, to be honest. There have been calls this week to improve the working conditions and the pay of HGV drivers to help just encourage more people in general to become HGV drivers. And there was also calls for people who have previously been driving these lorries to get back behind the wheel and get back into the job as well to help. But there have been people who maybe have been working in Britain and have gone back to the EU, and they've been asked, what do you think? And they sort of said, well, no, it's us coming to sort of help you get out of a problem that's been created essentially by Brexit and help you to get ready for Christmas. And then we've got to leave by Christmas Eve, so we can't actually enjoy it ourselves in Britain. So yeah, I think the fact that it's only for 3 months and it's all to be done and dusted by Christmas Eve's a real sticking point for people, I think.
And I spoke with the First Minister earlier this week when she was in Dundee to announce social security jobs, which will see 2,000 new positions created across the country. But she did say that she was fearful. She did raise her fears or concerns, certainly, regarding Christmas and empty shelves. Andy, do you think it's too early to be worried about that? I know that we're not allowed to put pictures of Santa or festive images on the website just yet because the powers that be have decided it's too early. But is it too early to be worried about Christmas, do you think? Or are you going to be out shopping in advance, getting your gifts, making sure that it hasn't been spoiled?
No, I'm going with rationalising things and thinking perhaps Christmas. Let's go back to the days of Cromwell. Just cancel the lot. There's a lot to be said. It is early. Any number of catastrophes could still befall us. But I think it is too early. And you know, maybe I'm being slightly cynical here, but a long sort of succession of retailers saying, get out shopping, you know, it is quite early, and I don't really think we need to be, you know, getting down the toy shop right yet. But there are clearly big issues that need to be sorted, and there should be enough time, you know, if it's not beyond the wit of our governments, I would think, to to actually deal with the problems that have been so monumentally well flagged up in advance. If there is problems at Christmas, then you know you have to wonder what is it, what is going on, and how can anyone fix anything? Well, that was bleak. Sorry.
That's all right. We like a bit of bleak. Today's the 1st of October, and I haven't worked on the other side of the fence. I worked in retail for the best part of 10 years before I became a journalist. I just like industries which are on the precipice, obviously. But, you know, by October, if you don't have your Christmas stock in, there is a worry. There is a fear that you're not going to do that well. So I can see, you know, I know it might sound a bit cynical to say, you know, for big retailers saying, get in and buy now, just in case. But there is also a planning mm-hmm. concern. But maybe I've still got
a little sideline in consultancy for you there somewhere.
That's what I'm thinking. You know, check out my LinkedIn profile. It's it could be one of those retail advisors. No, please don't ever make me work in retail again. I'd much rather just sit and take the abuse that you get on Twitter as a journalist than the real life abuse that people that work in retail have to face every day. Anyway, empty Christmas shelves and empty fuel pumps. It has almost harked back to the 70s, although none of us were around to remember that, I don't think. Andy, you weren't born in the 70s, were you?
Yes, I was. I was.
Oh, were you? Tail end of the 70s, though.
Yeah, I remember it well.
That's like me pretending I remember the 80s and the Thatcher.
The haze of Calpol.
But I don't. And I know Rachel and the Thatcher, just young things too. It has been quite interesting seeing that other side of things as well. From, you know, is it, you know, those memes you get on the, I'm doing it again, I'm explaining a meme on podcast. You know, it's like, you see it on Facebook, it gets shared. It's like, I remember when we could go out to play and, you know, we would play on trucks and tarmac machines and it was great. And you had frost on the inside of your window and you know, you didn't care about things like the EU and, you know, a child died every week in the news. But I'd see quite a lot of people saying that they're ready for another winter of discontent, but I don't know about you. It terrifies me. I hate the thought of a fuel shortage. I have grown used to my home comforts. I like the internet and I like heating in my house. I certainly don't want frost or ice on the inside of my windows. But I would use Rosine shampoo. So, you know, you've got to take the...
That was a curveball.
Is that not a thing? Yeah. Remember Vosine shampoo and Matey bubble bath? You know, God, the past was brilliant. I want those rose tinted specs, but I certainly don't want to experience the hardships of the 70s. You heard it here first. Speaking of things which haven't gone quite to plan, vaccine passport. I feel like we've been talking about the vaccine passport as well quite a lot on the show. It's a very important element for the Scottish Government's fight against the coronavirus. But there's been quite a fair few people who are involved in the scheme, so the nightclubs that haven't enforced this, have taken a bit of umbrage, to say the least, at what has been not a well thought out plan, according to them and according to the Scottish Conservatives. And lo and behold, the day it rolls out, the app seems to have crashed. Has anyone downloaded the app yet? Has anyone had a look at it? Leslie-Anne, are you registered? Are you a real person?
I'm not a real person, no. And I said this on Twitter, I'm a heavy user of the NHS. I've had several operations where nurses will laugh at me for waking up out of anaesthesia and immediately telling them my CHI number. And I still don't exist, according to this NHS app.
Like a prisoner of war.
A bit like that, yeah.
Yeah. Andy, how's it worked for you?
Badly, I gave up, yeah. It's definitely trying to tell me that I'm just not supposed to go out anymore. So no, I tried it last night and I heard the... Well, first of all, I didn't know which one it was. I don't think that was clear at all. And I see that other people having that same... Maybe I was just being stupid, I don't know. But I was looking at the wrong thing and then at the right thing, tried to take a picture of my own face from a tiny little thing on my driver's license, and then it just went, nah, you don't exist. But maybe I'll try again later.
So it uses the image on your driver's license. My driver's license was taken when I was 17 and... Age has not been kind to me, so I don't look like I did when I was 17. I don't even look like I did when I was 30, and I'm 32. So, and there's multiple apps.
I did the same thing as Andy. I got totally confused. I
searched for NHS Scotland on the App Store and it came up with about 5 different apps. I downloaded one, realised it was the wrong one because it had nothing to do with vaccines, but it was something else to do with COVID. And then I had to Google what the exact wording was that I meant to use to find it. So, yeah, it's not exactly clear.
Rachel, you're pretty young and tech savvy. Have you had issues getting the app?
I haven't even given it a shot yet because I have ordered a paper copy and my paper copy has arrived in the letterbox. But I think I probably should keep up with the times and get the digital version downloaded. I'll maybe give that a shot this afternoon, yes.
Paper copy and letterbox. You seem like one of these people that's happy that we're returning in the 1970s.
Well, it means that I've got my passport, so...
So you're going out clubbing tonight?
We'll see. Yeah, we'll see.
The producer, Chris, is showing off that he has successfully done his. I expect nothing else from a tech guru.
You're dancing alone, though, by the looks of it.
Yeah, he's dancing by himself. That's the problem. In that Robin song. I haven't downloaded it, but with a newborn, I don't think I'll be out past 7 o'clock anyway. Is it a shame that it has been so spectacularly junked from the start? Did we all expect it to be like this? Was it doomed from the beginning at the fact that so many people, including politicians and industry insiders, seemed to not want it from the start? Andy, we know that a nightclub owner in Dundee, Tony Cochran, who runs a chain including Fat Sam's, the world famous Fat Sam's, has said that he's not going to be checking. And we joked last week about the fact that when you go to nightclubs, usually you go when you're underage and they're not checking IDs, which means are they going to likely check your pass? Was it doomed to failure, do you think? Or are we just being overly negative and will we get an angry message from the Scottish Government after this has gone to broadcast?
Yeah, well, the defence was in quickly. They said, well, it was always going to happen. So many people were looking for it on day one. But the run-up, it's been, you know, known about for so long and there's been so much planning and then suddenly it's like right up to the wire. You know, we're talking about whether or not it was actually going to come into place while politicians were saying they still don't know about it. And the Court of Session was hearing a challenge which may have blocked it. That failed, but it was right up to the wire. It just seems that it was done with a long lead up and then all of a sudden a kind of bit of a panic. That's how it's come across. And the fact that the Scottish Government had to build in a sort of new grace period before actual enforcement begins does suggest that it's not been planned as best as it should have been. I think that's the only evidence that there is that, you know, it hasn't gone entirely as anyone would have wanted it to have gone.
In a way, it makes sense if you're using it. Is this passport the same one that you would take if you were to go abroad? Do we know? I'm completely ignorant about this because I'm not going abroad for a while. Is this the same one that you would show when you're going to an airport to prove that you've been double vaxxed?
Oh, I have no idea.
After a quick Google, it turns out, yes, it is the same one that you use to internationally travel. And you need to, so Andy, you said you put in your driver's license details. Do you need to put your passport details in as well? Or?
Oh, I don't know. I never got that far.
Yeah. One or the other asked you to either take a picture of your passport or your driver's license. And then it used some kind of biometric scanning to scan your face to check that it matched with the image in your official ID.
That was the award-winning Leslie Ann Kelly talking us through that there. We'll more on her award-winningness later on in the programme. But you can almost see what the Liberal Democrats have been getting at in terms of how it is an illiberal scheme in the UK and in Scotland. We don't require to carry our passports or our driver's license with us. We don't need ID cards like you do in several countries in the EU, like Germany. Rachel, have they got a point? Is this too invasive on civil liberties to have to prove that you've been vaxxed up to get into a nightclub?
Well, this has been something they've said from the very beginning. As soon as vaccine passports even got mentioned in Holyrood, the Liberal Democrats were very much saying no to it. And maybe perhaps they did have a point now, because we are now seeing problems with trying to get everyone sorted out with one having to put their passport details in, etc., etc. And it will exclude some people from certain activities. So perhaps they did have a point. I don't know at this point. We'll need to sort of wait and see how it sort of works in practice now, won't we?
Yeah, and Andy, the Scottish Conservatives maybe got themselves in a bit of a sticky wicket in the sense that the UK government still hasn't quite ruled out introducing vaccine passports for people in England, and yet they've been hypercritical of the Scottish government Is this one of those things where they're just going down partisan constitutional lines, or?
Well, it looked that way to start with, but you know, that problem was, it was effectively neutered when the UK government did say they're not going to bring them in at the time. So it's on the back burner, but I mean, they've got plenty of time, I suppose, to see how other schemes are working and whether or not they do it themselves. But it doesn't look like they're in any rush to bring anything like this forward anytime soon.
Do you think anyone else is frustrated at the sort of staggered approaches that we are taking as part of the UK, not as part of the UK, but in the UK? It seems that Wales is doing something different, England's doing something different, Northern Ireland does something different, Scotland does something different. Do you think people are going to get frustrated and seem a bit joined up? I was in North Wales last weekend at a family christening, and to get to North Wales, you have to travel through England. So in England, there was no requirement to wear face masks. You get in, to get to Wales, you do wear a face mask, but not in restaurants or in pubs. So I walked in wearing a face mask and looked like I was holding the place up. And then I got back to Scotland, and by the time I got to the pump, I'd forgotten that I needed to wear my face mask, and then got shouted at by the guy in the petrol, quite rightly shouted at by the guy in the petrol station, as I was putting £1.55 a litre's worth of fuel in my car, I should say, because that's all they had left in the petrol station, and I would have been stranded outside Glasgow had I not done that. So I was bankrupt, as well as morally bankrupt by not wearing my mask. It's confusing, and do you think people get frustrated in the end? Guys, what are your thoughts on that? Rachel, do you think people get frustrated at the lack of joined up thinking in, as we tackle the coronavirus in this end stage, or the hopefully end stage?
I suppose this will affect people who live near the borders and go back and forth. I'm thinking of family that I have in Wales who are very close to the English border and very regularly go between the two. So those people will probably sort of see it the most, won't they? They'll be the ones that sort of have to flip back and forward between the two options. So perhaps for them, it probably is quite strange to see all the different rules. For people who are perhaps not going to be travelling outside of Scotland, though, it probably won't affect them too much. So it'll only be something that's happening over in the border where they're not going to be. So I'm going to Northern Ireland this month now, it's October, so I'll be quite interested to see how things go there as well.
Different rules, but it's almost like you have to study up as well as download a passport. It's confusing times that we live in.
I need to check all the rules.
Some people enjoy that more than others. Now, speaking of things that people enjoy more than others, we had a conference season has started. We had the SNP conference a few weeks ago, and just this last weekend, we had the Labour Party conference, which was the first time Sir Keir Starmer, had an opportunity to give an in-person speech since becoming leader in 2020. Andy, you've been following that a bit. His speech, there wasn't very much to say about Scotland other than what he'd already said before, was there?
Yeah, I mean, it was a huge speech. It was so long and so very, very long. But I don't know, I think that it was pretty light on policy, and the section on Scotland was very small. I mean, this was his key moment, and he had to win over a crowd. He said he's the son of a toolmaker who wants to fix everything, but was quite light on what he actually has in the workshop. He berated people for parroting slogans, but he still had his own, you know, to chant back to the supporters. He didn't really want to get down in the party mudslinging, but he also had personal insults to throw at Boris Johnson. Scotland had a small billing, which he really laboured the point. He made like valid political statements, you would say, about like the SNP's record. You'd expect that from a rival party, but they're not in themselves arguments for the union. It was more of an election debate. The crowds liked the comment, I think, about Scots not caring if they donate blood on the NHS and it goes to an English person. But I thought it was quite crass, to be honest. He was quoting Gordon Brown, you may remember, saying, "When a Welsh or a Scottish woman gives blood, she doesn't demand an assurance it must not go to an English patient." And this is evidence of how terrible nationalism could be. I couldn't understand quite who he was preaching to, because I was having a wee think about anyone that I know who might be pro-independence or maybe a bit curious about it. Not that fussed, but maybe on the fence even. And it's quite quick to come to the conclusion in my mind that none of them that I know would ever hold that thought in their heads. So And if anyone does, they're beyond persuasion. So I'm not sure. He got a cheer from the faithful, but I think he still didn't, if anything, risk turning off a whole group of people with that kind of comment. It just seems so kind of unreasonable. Where he did have a good day was possibly publicly drawing a line between the Corbyn era and his own. The public put-downs to the heckles in the crowd perhaps reminds some of when Neil Kinnock had to take on the old guard in his attempt to reset the party, but then what happened to Neil Kinnock?
He fell over. So it's an interesting, it seems that when the government, the UK government can't seem to help falling over themselves with crises after crises, that Labour are stuck fighting each other. That's the impression I got from the conference. And it doesn't seem to matter who's in charge. If when Corbyn was in charge, it was Corbynistas versus anti-Corbynistas or the so-called right of the Labour Party. And it doesn't seem to have moved on from then. They're still fighting internal battles that's really going to put the electric off. Really going to put the electorate off.
Thinking of the 70s again there.
Yeah.
I know what you mean.
Really going to put, yeah. Well, it seems like the Labour Party are stuck in the 70s, they're stuck in the 80s. And the polling doesn't suggest that there's much shift either, does it?
No, but the I think he did do enough to keep his own side happy and to, I think it was important for him to face down the people who are trying to topple him. I don't know how it will translate into the real world, but certainly from the party perspective, I think it did demonstrate that maybe that they're the majority now in the party. Perhaps not in the membership, and they've got their own battles. I mean, nobody really wants to hear about the electoral college and how their votes are all counted for leadership. That's just complete eyes glaze over stuff. But Keir Starmer presented himself as a leader. There was enough, I think, in the speech to keep people who want him there happy. He put down his opponents possibly enough. I don't think he addressed Scotland even nearly enough. But and that says a lot about where the Labour Party are right now.
And that seems to be the main talking points that we've come away, not the some of the challenges to government or leader of the opposition position that they should be in. We'll see. We'll talk more about Conservative Party Conference next week, I am sure. Now, I mentioned earlier in the show that we were joined by the award-winning Leslie Ann Kelly. We have been joined by Leslie Ann Kelly, of course, in the past, where she has enlightened us with all things data journalism. Very, very happy to say that she was named Specialist Journalist of the Year at the Scottish Press Awards this week. So a big cheer for Leslie Ann and everyone else at TC Thompson who came away victorious. I think we were had quite the good haul this year. Leslie Ann, we're going to talk a bit about data journalism this week. I know we have talked at length about the work that you've done for our coronavirus and vaccine trackers. But really, first of all, congratulations. Well done.
Thank you.
Hip hooray and all that. Obviously, you're very pleased to have won. But really, more importantly, it's showing how relevant and important data journalism is to the industry and news gathering as a whole, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, 5 years ago, you wouldn't really know what a data journalist was years ago, and now you're winning all our awards.
Yeah, it probably depends where you're looking, but data journalism definitely did a bit of disaster capitalism during the pandemic and came much more to the forefront. And I'm going to make a leap here from the Scottish Press Awards to the Pulitzers, so bear with me, but data journalism basically swept the board at the Pulitzers. And it's always nice to see that kind of thing translating across the pond, because it doesn't always, because the category I was in, I was the only data journalist in that category, so to win it was, I think, really a nice thing for the data journalism industry to see us up against other types of reporters and still coming away with the prize. It was really nice to see.
So talk us through a bit about what a day in the life of a data journalist is. What, you know, it's not just all stats and tables, is it? You've got to be able to interpret them and present them clearly so that, you know, idiots like me can understand it.
Yeah, I think modern data journalism relies a lot on visuals. That is something that my team does quite a lot. We make lots of charts and maps and things like that to help people visualise the data that we're representing. Obviously, we need to analyse that data, whether that involves spreadsheets or coding or however that comes about, and then a bit of reading generally to understand the background of the data that you're analysing, because without that you can very easily make some very silly mistakes that you wouldn't want to. But it kind of, it sits and kind of overlaps in many different areas. So there's obviously, there's a little bit of writing involved. There's graphics involved. So there's creativity involved. And there's technical skills involving being able to deal with numbers or being able to write code or things like that. So it's a kind of cross-disciplinary type of thing. But Day in My Life, our team, my newly formed data team, which is very nice because for a long time I was talking to myself and the voices in my head and the dog. But we take requests from the other teams in DC Thompson Media where we help them with stories or we make charts to help their stories, to help visualise the data that they're talking about in their stories, or we work collaboratively with other teams on kind of bigger projects, like, for example, the recent Stuck in Rent impact story that we worked on with the impact team, Sean O'Neill. And off the back of that, we launched a big house price tracker that will be constantly updated with house price data to help people in our patches to understand how to get on the housing market if it's possible. So we work on various different things. We work on longer term things. We work on our own content as well. So things like trackers and things like, we'll work on FOI requests that we do ourselves or statistical releases like suicide statistics, or was one of the things that we worked on fairly recently, drug deaths, things like that. We try and help put those pieces of data into context, and it does tend to be quite often grim things that we're talking about, and it's actually quite nice for us to be on this issue and not be talking about, not be here because the COVID deaths have suddenly gone through the roof again. So, but yeah, it can be quite grim, but I quite like to balance out that grimness with data journalism can be fun, is something that would be my PhD subject if someone wanted to fund that.
I'm sure there's plenty of people wanting to fund that.
Yeah, well, offers and see my Twitter bio for email address if you want to make that offer to me. But we work on things like, people know, if you follow me on Twitter, I'm very passionate about baby names. That is, as far as I'm concerned, one of the most interesting data releases that you see in Scotland. It tells you so much about life in Scotland and how trends are changing. And things like when we released our house price tracker, there's a chart in there that made it into a few kind of industry publications for being quite fun, which was, we visualised how many bottles of Iron Brew people would have to forgo to get into the housing market in their area. And that's, it's adding a little fun element to things, that it's a stressful thing if you're trying to buy a house and the numbers are so big and scary and hard to visualise, that one of the things that we try and do is to try and help put that into context and try and make it a bit less scary. So yeah, data can be fun is something that I'm often banging on about. It's not always just depressing, grim statistics.
Now, you said you use statistics and charts, but there is one chart you will refuse to use, isn't there?
I don't know. No, and see, this is a lie. I will not refuse to use a pie chart.
Are you sure? I've asked for you to do loads of pie charts.
No, people troll me by asking me to do pie charts. I've always said I will do a pie chart if it's the best chart for the data. Just never has been. So, I mean, I did once make a joking pie chart that was a literal pie with chips and beans. So I have used pie charts in the past if it's the right chart for the data. And when it was visualising how much pie I'd eaten, then that was the right chart for the data. So, but yeah, it's a talking point in data journalism industry if you want to get deep into the weeds as to controversialness of pie charts. And I mean, you would think we are actually, Dundee is the home of pie charts, if you're to believe certain historical statisticians that claim to have invented pie charts, so we should be using them.
Really?
Good pub quiz question.
It really is.
We also invented Beatlemania as well, if you're to believe if it's to be believed. So we could maybe have Leslie and Kelly Mania.
I can attest to the sort of user friendly nature of the data journalism, because I think I was maybe one of those that probably thought, you know, data journalism is stats and graphs and lines, and sometimes you just think, ah, just let me read the words. But obviously, And thinking wrongly that you need to be a certain kind of temperament to actually dig into all that. But, you know, we've done stories, and Leslie Ann has provided some great stuff that's really helped something I was writing work. And whether it's just a really simple visualization of where your local authority is, I mean, at its most basic, to the stuff that we did a few weeks ago, which was building on Edinburgh University's work as well on witches.
Yeah, that's one of the most fun data sets I've ever worked on.
Yeah,
no, it was so brilliant. Much fun. Where's your local witch? I mean, it went mad on Facebook because people were tagging people in it saying, oh, are you in this map? Because it was a map of local witches.
Yeah, and they had, you know, it was done really well with, and a little bit of humour to it as well, with the sort of the icons that were used. And but it was really, really user-friendly and it was really helpful. And then you could click on each little individual bit, zoom in on a map, see where everything was, or you could just know it was there and read the story and you were happy. It was good. So it has kind of helped all of us, I think, get a bit better at telling stories.
I've definitely noticed since the change in the way that we tell stories in the DC Thompson newsroom, people are definitely much more comfortable with data journalism than they used to be. It definitely used to be much more of a, people would come to me in a bit of a panic. I've got a spreadsheet. I don't really know what to do with it. Can you help? Whereas now that people see more and more of what me and my team do, it's much more, they come to us with very set ideas of, because they've seen something and think, oh, I could use that for my story. And that's nice. So it's nice to see that people even within our newsroom are getting more familiar with it off the back of seeing the work that my team are doing. So yeah, it's nice. It's an exciting field to work in right now, and hopefully once we can stop tracking pandemic stats, there will still be an interest in data journalism. That's my aim anyway.
Well, another thorough congratulations, Azan, and I know that I've been coasting off your skills in data journalism for years, and I'm glad you've been able to come into the studio so I can coast some more. But that's it for this week. Thank you to Rachel, Andy, and of course Leslie Ann, producer Chris, and you for listening. We'll be back next week with more, but until then, and even after, pick up or log on to The Courier, The Press and Journal, and all of our news brands so that you can be better briefed. Cheerio!
The Stushy is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you can be better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph, Evening Express and The Sunday Post work hard day and night, online, in print and beyond, to bring you careful reporting and analysis designed to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, in Westminster and in our communities. So you don't miss an episode, follow The Stushy today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you know folk like you who want to understand politics in Scotland a little better, suggest they tune into The Stushy or follow Stushy Scott on Twitter and Facebook. You can get a free month of unlimited access to The Courier or The Press and Journal too. Just go to thecourier.co.uk/subscribe or pressandjournal.co.uk/subscribe or follow the links in the episode notes to be better briefed. Check the episode notes for details and terms.